Well, it's 11 o'clock, and you are tuned to Free Vermont Radio, WFVRLP in South Royalton. Henry's with me in the studio. It's a Thursday, so it must be time for Green Zine, our weekly environmental news magazine, and it's pretty busy again, as usual. And we've got some music queued up that's based on a story that we're going to cover at least briefly. So stay tuned with us, and please watch out for the bears.
Lines in the squares, be careful that you don't step on the bears. There are bears on the stairs, often dares, and they're very hard to get along with. So be careful not to utter a sound that will disturb. There's something about honey makes a bear kind of funny, especially when it's time to eat.
This is Green Zine. Please bear with me for a moment, and we'll get back to the bears. Green Zine is brought to you today by Solaflect, also by Bail, building a local economy, hosting a farmers market every Sunday well into the middle of September from 11 a.m. till 2 p.m. Tom Wells, Daniel Leibowitz, who was just in the studio an hour ago, our original treasurer, minding the books 13 to 14 years ago, the Upper Pass Beer Company, and the Yes We Can Collective. Well, before bringing Henry up in the mix, I'm going to tell you why I played that song, which I didn't know we had in the studio, but we did. It's from Quicksilver Messenger Service. It is called Bears, and it was inspired by a story in Vermont Digger. I would highly recommend, if you want independent media here in the state of Vermont, you check them out at vtdigger.org. And the headline from just a couple days ago under the environment column, the worst possible catch 22, Fish and Wildlife, Vermont Fish and Wildlife struggles to combat bear rumors. As bear-human incidents continue at record rates in Vermont, the state Fish and Wildlife Department is encountering public misperception that is leading Vermonters to avoid reporting minor bear activity because they fear that the bear will be killed. This often leads to the worst possible catch-22 for the bears, says Joshua Morse, public information officer for the department. Situation not being properly addressed until it has escalated much further, so much that it can be difficult, if not impossible, to de-escalate without considering killing the bear. He says, I wish people knew that what happens when you call us 99% of the time is that we give you advice on how to coexist with the bear. That's what we want to be doing, and that is what mostly happens. Vermont has a large population of around 7,000 black bears, about one for every 100 residents that reside in all areas of the state except up there in the Champlain Islands. The mammal's sense of smell is 2,100 times better than yours and mine, and they have an excellent long-term memory. able to remember the location of food sources years after an initial visit. Black bears are opportunistic omnivores. You probably know someone like that. And will eat just about anything they find, especially during the spring and early summer when their highest fat natural food sources, beech nuts and acorns, are not yet available, and they continue to draw upon last year's remaining fat reserves. So just a few paragraphs from that story. You can get all the information and get the advice from Vermont Fish and Wildlife by checking it out at vtdigger.org. Now I'm going to push the button and see if Henry is on mic. Morning, Henry.
Good morning. Yes, I feel as though I'm on mic.
You're on mic. We got you loud and clear. How are you doing?
Yeah, so I'm good. And been down at my house doing chores and mounting to something.
Well, that's good. Productive.
Yes, productive.
Being very productive. You have a great spot there now, particularly with all those extra solar panels that you put in.
Yes, yeah. Indeed. And that's a wave to the adding efficiency, taking advantage of the efficiency of nature. Mm-hmm. Sun is part of nature, so don't know whether that's yeah. And so we have a bird note today, which is birds that take advantage of when there is plenty in nature, and we land up with extra food supply. So we'll be getting to that in a moment. My solar panels are pretty steep. 45 degrees or so. So they're not ideal for summer sun, but I wanted to maximize my winter sun because I have quite a lot of solar panels compared to the amount of load I have.
Yeah, that's good. Maximize the winter sun. It's coming right up.
Yeah, well, it'd be nice to have it adjustable. I'm thinking about that too. So so we'll be getting into that because we have Solar Fest coming up. But let's listen to that bird note and see what the birds do about an abundance in nature.
Let's go. This week's bird note on Green Zine is brought to you by us, but it's called Crossbill's Nest in Winter.
This is Bird Note. From the tip-top of a black spruce, a white-winged crossbill sings a rapid-fire tribute to winter. He's got good reason to sing. Even in the cold, crossbills are nesting. Among virtually all our songbirds, the breeding season begins with the longer, warmer days of spring and the seasonal bounty of insects, fruits, and seeds. But for crossbills, it's all about the food. When the evergreens hang heavy with snow and cones, crossbills can get all the calories they need for the demands of reproduction, courtship, egg laying, and feeding young. North America's two crossbill species, white-winged and red, are vagabonds, wandering in flocks until they find a suitable cone crop, where they might then stop to breed in small groups almost any time of year. Crossbills are finches, and yes, their bills do cross at the tip, an oddity that helps them pry and extract seeds from those nutritious cones of spruce, fir, pine, and tamarack. So even in the grips of winter, when most songbirds are months away from the breeding season, somewhere among the snowy conifers, crossbills are already warming up. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Yeah, we like to include Bird Note as a regular part of our program each week here on Green Zine. And the show, which was pretty busy, is just getting busier as we speak. We're going to have two guests on the show. One of them who has been with us before, and that is Jennifer Byrne. And we just got confirmation that one of the presenters at next Saturday's Solar Fest, which will be mentioning quite a bit today and also next week. It's happening over in Brandon, Vermont, all day long on Saturday, the 8th of August, with plenty of workshops. And we're going to be welcoming one of the presenters, Tim Giles, towards the end of the show. Right now, I'm going to go to another story because I think Henry's trying to get in touch with our earlier guest. And this event is happening today, so I wanted to get the word out to you. It's a really well-known group, Vermont Coverts, a peer-to-peer community of landowners, professionals, and others learning from and supporting each other to enhance wildlife habitats, yeah, for birds and for bears, through sound forest management, is hosting an open event today, July 30th, that would be today, in Granville. That's not that far from here. The 4:30 to 7:30 p.m. event will be at Buffalo Farm, 1118 Buffalo Farm Road. I think I've ridden my bike on that road in Granville. So once again, 1118 Buffalo Farm Road, 4:30 to 7:30. I think it's going to be dry at that point. Folks who are tackling invasive species, wondering how others are managing for ticks, curious about the results of the horse logging project at Buffalo Farm, or excited to share a recent wildlife sighting, will find much to appreciate at the event. According to the press release from Vermont Coverts, join us to share what's happening on your land. Whether you have questions, ideas, successes, or challenges, this is a chance to learn from one another. So if you're not busy later on, get over to Granville, 4:30 to 7:30, and learn a whole lot more about that fine nonprofit organization called Vermont Coverts. There, I slid that one in on you, Henry.
Yeah, it was excellent.
Yeah.
So we've had a guest in past years talking about coverts, and yep, they are little pockets that you generate where nature can really thrive, and wildlife in particular.
Yeah, yeah. It's one of those things that you, just as a common citizen who might have the proper, the right property for that, can do something proactive without really, too much work. I know that Larry Mengado from Tunbridge is very active with coverts, and I think we're going to have a future guest from Sharon. I think Kevin Gish is also involved with that organization. He's a member of the select board in Sharon.
He is. That's correct.
So, yeah. Well, I'm just trying to pull things out of my brain there, Henry.
You're doing good.
Yeah, so far, so good. All right. What's up your sleeve now, Henry?
So, our first guest when they call in is Jennifer
Byrne.
Yeah. And she's with the White River Soil Conservation District in the West Lebanon, White River area, the White River Junction area, which covers us. There's a number of these agencies in various parts of the state, and they are sponsoring a conference coming up, which we mentioned at the very tail end of last week's show, and that conference is having the person that's in charge of the state bank from North Dakota.
North Dakota, which I think is the first state to have a state bank.
No? Okay. I cleared that with her. I thought it was too. She says that it is the only remaining state. That a number of states early on did state banks, and then the commercial banking started crowding them out. So, but there is efficiency in doing a state bank, and that efficiency has a lot of paybacks. And just like the Crossbills taking advantage of food supply when it's abundant and nesting in what we would consider out of season for other birds, they step up and make use of conifer seeds when they're plentiful.
Yeah,
and solar takes advantage of the sun, and we'll be having a solar guest on later.
Yeah,
and then state banking is an efficiency system. And Jennifer may have numbers on this, but I recollect from meetings I've gone to on state banks promoting that idea a number of years ago, that maybe you get an effective drop in interest rate of about 2%, which makes for a more efficient economy. And the state banks are only good for certain things. They can't do it all. I think that might be
that
our
could
guest.
Be our guest calling in right now. Let's go to the magic button. We have a lot of magic buttons here in the studio, and we have activated that. And if Jennifer is there on the line, she can hear us now. We're going to assume that that's her. Should we bring her up?
Could be a vacuum cleaner salesman.
Well, actually, I am looking for, there's a repair fair going on in Brookfield this weekend, and I might be taking my vacuum up there. Let's check in and see if, is that you, Jennifer, joining us on the air?
It sure is.
Hey, oh, so
good. Your timing is, well, maybe immaculate is too strong a word, but is very immediate and very, we're very happy to have you back with us here on Green Zine.
Yeah.
Yep.
It's good to be back. Thank you for inviting me.
You're welcome.
So we have about 20 minutes. We're once again back into a two-guest show.
Yeah, but Jennifer called a little bit early, so
well,
we have more like 23 minutes.
That's because she's on her phone. She's checking her messages last
good
minute.
Good for her.
Thank you. So we've just been talking about the efficiency of Crossbill's nesting when there's plentiful food supply in the middle of the winter, and then about solar panels, efficiency of gathering free sunlight, because that's going to be our next guest. And I'm hoping that you can talk to us about the efficiency of a state bank, making it so that the system is lower cost to operate. It maybe gives a way of having lower interest rates. Am I right about that?
Yes, wouldn't it be nice? sure. Do you want me to give a little intro to?
Absolutely, go for it. I said we had a conference coming up, but that's all I said.
Great. Well, yes, next week, August 4th and 5th, our conservation district is hosting the president of the Bank of North Dakota here in Vermont, and we're hosting a public banking congress. So it's a two-day event. The real meat of it will happen on the 5th at Vermont Law School. So if you've ever had any curiosity about public banks, hopefully it will all be explained at that day, you know, kind of top to bottom. The day before, we'll be really focused on the farming aspect. We have a farm tour and a farmer dinner where Don Morgan, the president of the Bank of North Dakota, will be speaking about specifically his agricultural lending programs. But yes, we have a, for starters, my name is Jennifer Byrne. I'm the district manager of the White River Natural Resources Conservation District, which is one of Vermont's 14 conservation districts established way back after the Dust Bowl. We're really our nation's decentralized, democratically led watershed governments, and we work every day with farmers and municipalities and communities across, for us, central Vermont. And we help people access conservation funding and implement projects that improve soil health and water quality and flood resilience and farm viability. And so over the years, through our community engagement, we've noticed, and through our technical assistance, we spend a lot of time helping farmers find funding, but we spend just as much time helping them navigate the financing system itself. And even when funding exists, farmers are usually expected to pay thousands and thousands of dollars up front and carry debt while waiting for reimbursement from government programs, or they put their conservation projects, for example, on high interest credit cards. And so that led us as a conservation district to ask this bigger question, which is, can our financial system do a better job supporting the public investments we're already trying to make? And so that question eventually leads us to public banking. I can go into that just a little bit if you want a little bit of an intro there.
Yeah, explain how a public bank is different than
a commercial bank.
A commercial bank, yeah. I guess a for-profit bank.
And particularly when it comes to lending and being involved in the community and thinking of North Dakota and Vermont, both pretty rural states.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and a public bank is actually a pretty simple idea, and it's actually the idea that really started banks in our country. There used to be many public banks. Vermont had a public bank back in the early 1800s, and private banks saw how good banking was for business, which is why they got into the banking business. So public banks have, you know, a really long history and do work for the people. It's a pretty simple idea. It's a bank owned by the people of the state, in the case of a state bank, instead of private shareholders. And so instead of depositing our public funds, like our taxes and the revenue that the state holds, instead of depositing all of those funds into large national banks to be held onto and invested, a public bank holds those state deposits and uses them to support public priorities like agriculture, housing, infrastructure, disaster recovery, student loans. Those are all things that North Dakota Bank pays for or provides loan products for. One thing that most people don't realize is that banks don't simply lend out existing money, but that when a bank makes a loan, it actually creates new credit, and credit is money. And that credit enters the economy and it finances real activity. And so a public bank uses that same banking function, but under a public mission. And so instead of directing that lending wherever it's most profitable, the legislature and the people can decide that the credit that it creates can be directed toward Vermont's long-term needs. And as loans are repaid, that lending capacity revolves and grows over time, creating a long-term capacity rather than relying solely on one-term appropriations. So it's really important to know, too, that the state bank doesn't replace community banks. In fact, the Bank of North Dakota primarily partners with local banks, helping them to make more loans and de-risk their loans so they can actually provide more credit into the community than they would be able to on their own while keeping more of that economic benefit inside the state.
So you've said something which I've learned about a number of years ago, and it's something that I had no idea, and that's that concept of when you generate credit, you're generating money. That all money is borrowed into existence is another line from the person I learned from it. Can you just explain that a little bit more? That's a hard concept to get your head around.
It really is. And the great thing is I'll pitch on the 5th at Vermont Law and Graduate School. We'll be there all day from 9 to 4. Registration starts at 8 and breakfast. But we kick off the day with a little mini what is money lesson from a Harvard professor, Christine Dizon. And that would be a great thing for anyone to hear. This will be recorded. There is a virtual option. But the way that she describes it, it makes it a little bit more understandable. I'm not a financial expert, but, you know, I have good teachers. It's really true, you know, that that credit itself is the value that we, you know, trade back and forth, not money, not a dollar, not a coin. And so, you know, when you get a loan, a bank is lending you quite a bit more, 8 to 10 times more than their actual physical assets that they hold. You know, it's a risk, but it's a risk that is backed by different types of banking insurance and is something that banks are willing to take on because they hold so much assets. They can lend 8 to 10 times more than those assets, knowing that the majority of the time, people will be paying back their loans and their debt, and they will be making an interest off of those. So, you know, in Bank of North Dakota, they really don't have a default problem where people don't, you know, the majority of their loans, as they've put it, don't go into any kind of default. People wind up paying them back, and that's more money, if it makes sense. You know, it's money that was spent into existence, essentially. It was credit that was used, let's say, to build a house, and now the value of that house exists. And it wasn't a dollar that did it. It was the ability to leverage your credit. So it is a really different way of thinking about money, but it's what money actually is. And even the government itself, you know, loans money through through the Fed and how that whole system works. So all those kinds of things are going to be what we're talking about on the 5th.
I'm trying to get my head around. You were saying that the community banks that exist around here already, that have been around, a lot of them get gobbled up and get larger, that they can actually partner with a state bank, when my other side of my brain says they're not going to like some other entity coming in with a different mission statement and that they might oppose that. Why would this be attractive to existing banks to have a state bank founded in Vermont?
Yeah. Well, it's important when it's a state bank to understand that the only depositor to that bank, meaning the only one who like holds a bank account, is the state. So in North Dakota, only North Dakota deposits money into this bank account. It's not like you can just open a bank account with a state bank. But what then the Bank of North Dakota does is it goes out to the many hundreds of lending institutions that they work through, and they develop their loan product, whether it's for disasters or student lending. They have participation lending. They have mission-based things. They have legislatively directed programs, which are always below market in terms of their interest rates. So that's if the state legislature decides we think this is important and we want to have a loan program and a product that does this, then the bank will need to develop that product. And so what the bank then can do and does do is it offers those products through these community institutions. Sometimes I don't know all the inner workings of how they build the product themselves. I think they work really closely hand in hand with the other lending institutions to develop the products. But like I said, you know, it goes a lot longer way when they can actually de-risk what a small community lending facility can do. You know, the Bank of North Dakota can come in and kind of increase their lending capability by a really substantial amount. So the community banks love it. It seems, in North Dakota, according to the stories that we're hearing, and that it's giving them a lot more ability to do a lot more in their community.
It's very much reminds me of EC Fiber. So we have, I don't know what we're up to, 34 towns or something now that join together and own that system. And because the towns are grouped together, EC Fiber was able to go to Wall Street and borrow money to build more infrastructure and do it much lower cost than we would have if we hadn't been towns coming to do it. And so we were making investments of infrastructure that were going to last for 50 years, but we had like a 20-year low interest loan to be able to do it. So that connection to the credit, the credit worthiness of that group of towns. And it wasn't as though the towns could be held accountable for it. The infrastructure that we built, kind of like the house that we built, that was the underlying credit for
the value
for the build, the value for the build.
Yeah.
And if we had done it with a state bank, I bet we could have gotten a lower interest yet. Because the state of Vermont has a lot of money sitting in its investment account, waiting for the next thing they have to spend money on.
Yes. Yeah, that's important to understand. Yeah, and it makes sense, I think, once you think about it, that, you know, the state has a lot of money sitting, and there's no such thing but a private bank, really, for Vermont to put their money in. And so, of course, that private bank is making money off of the money of Vermont. And the good news is Vermont could decide to charter a bank that's just something that they could really just choose to do. And they can put, you know, a chunk of their deposits into that self-owned bank where that profit, that investment profit comes back to them. And again, it's this, you know, interesting fact is that's how money is made. That's how money is created. Yeah. And, you know, in terms of like numbers, just in terms of the Bank of North Dakota, they've been around for over 100 years. So in 1919, there was a $2 million capital investment into their bank. And today they have $1.2 billion in capital and $10.6 billion in assets.
Ooh, wow.
Even, yeah.
In little old North Dakota. I mean, it's a big state, but there aren't that many people there.
It is a big state, and it doesn't take any annual appropriations. All the deposits go into the bank. It only makes money. It covers its own costs. It doesn't ever go to the legislature and ask for more money. It's making money for the state.
So to come back to this state, the brave little state, will financial officials from state government, will some of them be at this conference next week, do you think?
It seems like it. We're getting a really amazing, diverse array of people signing up from different economic and financial institutions, folks who are running for the legislature this year, you know, farmers and agricultural service providers, different types of economists. So we are getting a wide array. We'd love more. We've got probably about 50 people already signed up. The bus tour is definitely full, but we'd be willing to have folks, you know, travel along behind the bus if, on the 4th. And the farmer dinner on the 4th will be at Lake Maury. That's also, you know, filling up, but which I'm not going to put a cap on who signs up. So we're just welcoming everyone to join us.
That's great.
Excellent. Excellent. And you said there was a virtual component for the 5th, mm-hmm. for the second day of the conference. Oh, I guess that's what's yeah. for. Can you explain more about that?
Sure. Yeah. Well, we will be streaming. You know, we'll have a Zoom link that is, and folks who sign up on our website to attend will be sent the information so they could join virtually. Basically, we're going to go from about 9 a.m. to noon with plenty of presentation conversation. We're going to hear from Don Morton. We're going to hear from Christine Desan, What is Money? We're going to hear from Don Morgan, about the Bank of North Dakota and State Bank. And then we're going to have a really interesting panel discussion at 11 o'clock. So all those things, you know, if you want to tune in from far away, we welcome you. We'll also record it and have that available on our website.
Wow.
So I assume that there is a registration fee for those who want to attend both days or even one of the days.
No, be totally free. The only thing to expect paying for would be the 5th, Wednesday night, Wednesday evening after the Congress. We're going to have a public banking symposium, so dinner and drinks discussion at Fable Farm in East Barnard.
Oh.
That'll be from about like 5 to 8 around there. And that's where, you know, you pay for food, pay for drinks at that event. But besides that, breakfast and lunch is available at the Congress on the 5th at the law school, courtesy of the Center for Agriculture and Food Systems. And then on the 4th, the dinner is also free at Lake Maury. That's
wow.
Just what we're talking about.
Yeah, very, very enticing. And I think I know the space out of Fable Farm. That's probably going to be in the Rumney Barn.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a great space to get more educated and also have a pretty good meal. This is sounding very encouraging, and I hope some people from the state. I'm trying to remember. I believe at one point Beth Pierce is the name that is the state treasurer, but she may not be in that position. Hopefully, whoever is in the Treasury Department can come down and pick up on a lot of this. Just one more question for me, and that is with North Dakota having such a successful history, like you say, more than 100 years with this state bank. And other states did have state banks that basically went out of fashion or wasn't economically viable. Are there any other states attempting to revive state banks? Is it really complicated for them?
Yes, there's definitely a movement among many states. I'm aware of California. I'm aware of more of like a a city public bank. Philadelphia is really working on this. I've met folks from Massachusetts definitely working on this. Even, you know, heard about folks in New Jersey and New York. So there are people from all over the country, you know, attempting to do this in their own local regions. And we will hear that's one of our panelists, the president of the Public Banking Institute, will be joining us and sharing about those efforts across the across the country. And then we're also on our panel, we'll be joined by Alfeka Mutardi, who is a former IMF and also has is currently a part of the national public bank movement. That'll be really interesting to learn about. It's not, you know, where I've been focused on, but the movement for a national infrastructure bank as well. And so we'll hear about that perspective on the panel at 11 on the 5th.
Things you never thought you needed to know about. So, it seems like when something that is, community-based and for the people, there always seem to be for-profit people that are that kind of lean into wanting those things to be in their bailiwick instead of the lowest cost way. Are you anticipating pushback from the big banking corporations?
Well, it's hard to anticipate. I know that there's a history of folks in Vermont trying to do this in the past and, you know, really making strides. There's examples of sort of the remnants of the last effort of a state bank, which made a really big difference and led to the LIAC, the Local Investment Advisory Committee. That was all as a result of the movement for state banks. So I'm just going to stay positive and, I think that, we just move forward. So no pushback yet.
Excellent. Well, that's a very exciting program, and my hat's off you for having been instrumental in pulling this together and making it available to the public. I will definitely attend virtually if I can't attend in person. This subject is worth getting your head wrapped around and having an opinion so that you can raise your hand and nudge your legislator to pay attention to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
absolutely. And I'm glad some legislators are planning to attend. It is a very active primary season here in Vermont, and it'll be great to have them on board. Jennifer, always great to speak with you. I remember meeting you on the green a couple of years ago during one of the other events that the Conservation District put together, and good luck with the conference next week.
Thank you so much. Yeah, check out whiterivernrcd.org. Our events page is where you can register.
Will do.
And we will put that up in our show notes as well right after the show.
All right. We slid it in under the wire. Thanks again, Jennifer. Hope to see you soon.
Thank you so much. Right. See you soon.
Okay. Bye-bye. Okay, Henry. Wow. I think we did get to pretty much all that we needed to. And the phone is ringing again. Wow. I don't know. Let's just see. Yeah, I think we're going to go right to here. And we just hung up on a previous guest, but I have a feeling that we have our follow-on guest who's going to be involved with Solar Fest next Saturday, the 8th, a free event. Is this Tim Giles on the line?
This is Tim Giles.
Hey, Tim, your name sounds familiar. I think you probably have attended other solar fests in the past. Would I be correct in that assumption?
That's right.
All right. Well, you are here, and we're glad that that you're able to join us today. We're going to be talking about Solar Fest on our show next week. And just to remind folks, it's a scaled down as far as the amount of time, but the number of workshops are very active on Saturday the 8th. all kinds of subjects that we'll mention maybe later in the show, but we've got you down for kind of doing, well, it says save money with a DIY solar. It's easier than you think. And it sounds like this is something you've been involved with, maybe with your own personal property and other people. Can you give us a little background on some of the things you're going to discuss at your workshop?
Yeah. So I've been doing solar for, probably 30 years now. I did my first solar when I hung some panels outside my window of an apartment in Baltimore where I was studying at the time, and backfed the electricity into my panel.
Careful.
I've grown a lot, and I'm certainly a lot more legit. While I do solar, like for my little sailboat, what I'm really here to talk about is more house grade solar, 10 kilowatts, 15 kilowatts of electricity. I think there's going to be another workshop on, do it yourself, more small scale.
Yeah, I see that.
I'm really into trying to help people do solar on their homes and cut the cost way down. For example, I had a buddy that wanted to put up some solar, and he got a quote from, a good solar company, and understand that I have nothing against these really good solar companies. They do important work, and they're willing to get up on your roof and do the work. But if you are willing to get up on your roof and do some work, they had quoted my friend $45,000 to put up a 15-kilowatt system on his barn, and we ended up putting that system up for about $15,000. You save a lot of money by doing it yourself. And what this typically involves is, a couple mornings of putting up the rails and putting up the panels, and then you hire an electrician to do the last bit where it connects to GMP, so it's all copacetic and safe. And the evolution of solar is what's interesting to me because, when I started doing solar, 30 years ago, you really had to know how to wire things, and it was a lot more like a science project, where nowadays almost everything is plug and play. You do no wiring on the roof. It's all stringing plug to plug to plug. And really the only wiring comes down to the two wires that come down from your roof into the, inverter system, and that's where your electrician takes over.
That's good. I just built last year about 3,500 watts of a panel on my house, and it was that science experiment that you talk about because I was I wanted to be able to run the house on solar when I chose to run it on solar, and I had battery backup in the system. And it again was drastically underpriced. I figured the savings on my bill the payback was going to be a year and a half or 2 years for having done that work myself.
Most of the large companies when they install take about 20 years to pay back, and when I do the DIY systems, they typically pay back in about 7.
Yeah, I landed up finding some brand new panels that were 20 cents a watt, about a fifth the market price for panels, and that helped a bunch. And I also went to a Chinese inverter instead of an American made inverter, and that saved money. And I knew how to do wiring. I used to wire houses for a living, so.
Well, exactly. And I applaud people who want to go ahead and design their own because you can save a lot of money if you, get either used panels or low-priced panels or, all these different kinds of inverters. What I promote is actually working with a company called Gigawatt. And this is a company that sells all the standard solar equipment that the main, installers use. But they're it's a company designed to help DIY people, and so they have an electrical designer that will do all the electrical layout, and they have someone who can even give you help if you need to permit for roof loading with snow load and solar load on your roof. I mean, I just did a 23 kilowatt system for the Brandon Police Department as a DIY project. And this gigawatt company did all of the necessary design paperwork that we needed to, you know, to be able to install on a public building. So it's more that level that I think I'm interested in promoting, is this someone who wants to do it themselves, wants the grid tie, and just wants some support from this DIY environment.
I love that, and I think that will have a lot more traction with getting more solar up and helping with the climate change aspect than the trying to ferret out the people like me who are like you were when you were in school, being a bit of a cowboy about how they were doing it.
That's right.
It draws it into the mainstream.
Well, and the other part that I like to remind people is that, you know, Vermont is a very do-it-yourself state. You know, people have their own gardens. They grow a lot of their own food. Many people hunt for meat, and they like to supply their freezers with a good, you know, load of food. And it's not unusual for someone to, you know, shingle their roof or something, because it's not that hard to do some work on a roof if you're comfortable with ladders and roofs. And in fact, you know, putting up a solar system takes as little as 3 or 4 mornings. And I mean like 3 or 4 hours a morning. It typically takes a couple of mornings to put the rails up, and it takes a couple of mornings to put the panels up. And so it's really low-hanging fruit for many, you know, do-it-yourselfers.
Could I ask you to go back to this company Gigawatt that you said is very supportive of, of big-time installers,
yeah,
but also DIY? Is that where you would get the rails, you know, the mounting rails from a company
you
like
get
that?
The whole package. So originally Gigawatt was called WholesaleSolar.com, and that's when I first started using them, you know, 15 years ago. And then they got bought out by this place called Unbound Solar, and they got bought out by Gigawatt. And, you know, it's the industry that kind of finds people who are succeeding and then, you know, gathers them up into more and more successful size unit. When you order from them, you get a salesperson who will pretty much help you design your whole system from the ground up. And when you push the buy now button, 2 weeks later, they ship it to you on a semi-truck, and it shows up in your driveway as a pallet of panels, and typically a pallet of small parts, along with the rails. And when you go to install your system, that's everything. It's like there's just a little bit of going to the hardware store to buy, you know, electrical strain relief connectors or something like this. But everything for the solar system is on those two pallets. It's very convenient.
Wow, I like that. So, how about batteries? Are you typically putting batteries in the system
I do have batteries for my home here. I built myself a very small house and signed up immediately for the GMP battery program, which I encourage everybody to do. But I'd like to remind people batteries and solar are really two entirely different conversations. You can have batteries with or without solar, and you can have solar with or without batteries. And
yeah,
so I don't, I haven't installed batteries yet, but the great news is that, you know, there's a lot of companies making them nowadays, and people could get batteries. I'd love to take this moment, though, while I'm on your radio show, to put a plug in for batteries for the right reason. You know, many people think about batteries as a backup, you know, in place of a generator, and while that's a very good reason to have batteries, have power when the power goes down. A bigger reason to have batteries, which I want everybody to understand, is that it creates a cleaner grid for everybody else when you allow the power company to dip into your battery and borrow power when they need it and then put it back when they have extra power. And it cuts down on what I'm sure you guys both know is peaking power, which is the dirtiest power that the power company buys. And so it's really a socially responsible thing to do to get batteries, even if you don't need them yourself, because it creates this wonderful virtual power plant for that power company.
Yes. And Green Mountain Power, I believe, is really unusual among utilities across the country for having led the charge and cost sharing on batteries if they can borrow a little bit of that power back when they need it.
Yes, I give kudos to Green Mountain, and I give kudos to our legislators. It's one of the reasons why you see more solar, rooftop solar in Vermont than many other places in the country, certainly than the sunnier states like Texas or Florida. And it's because our power company and our government work together to create this wonderful net metering program that allows you to save power in the summer and use it in the winter, and it's brilliant.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, when you said net metering, and we are considering a couple of solar projects here in our community and one involved with the radio station, do you have any hope? And I know that your workshop is not really going to be talking about legislation that may come up at the next session in Montpelier, but for group net metering to make a resurgence here in Vermont, because it's been pretty much drawn down to zero at this point.
Yeah, programs like yours, this radio show, is the kind of conversations we need to have. And this is another one of these nuanced conversations where, you know, the power company is not an evil empire. They're appropriately identifying where costs in their system are, and then they're appropriately identifying who needs to pay those costs. The problem is, they've lost sight of the public benefit of solar power, the long-term savings that can't even be measured because, you know, how do you measure a future that's less and less livable? And this is where, as a state, we're in the right place to have these conversations and build up a social awareness for incentivizing solar again. And that means incentivizing group net metering, and it means getting back to where the adder, which I think you probably know, but your listeners may not realize, when I built my solar on my house that I'm living in now 11 years ago, I got paid 5 cents extra for every kilowatt of electricity I made because it was solar and it was clean and it was incentivized. And that adder of 5 cents went down to 3 and then 2 and then 1, and now it's actually negative 2 or 3, I think. It might even be 4. And while that is the real cost of solar using the grid, it's not incentivizing what we, I believe, want as a state. And we need to talk to our legislators and get this incentive back to where it should be.
Couldn't agree more, Tim. Hey, really looking forward to it. I'm not sure. I haven't asked Henry. Are you going to Solar Fest, Henry?
I'm going to Solar Fest.
Well,
I hope be in your workshop,
yeah,
Tim.
He'll be there, and he's always an interesting addition. And I see here on the schedule from Solar Fest that you will be outside, and your workshop starts next Saturday, August 8th at 10:30. Now, is that a half-hour workshop or a full hour? How long is your workshop?
You know, I don't know how long they have me scheduled in. That's I haven't been told. I'm assuming at least a half hour, and I'll certainly be there as long as people want to talk to me. For that matter, people can always look me up. I'm really a Johnny Appleseed of promoting solar. I like to help everybody. I don't charge for helping people with DIY solar. I just like to, give people the benefit of my experience and help, you know, guide them to a successful installation.
Well, you've done a lot of that here on the radio, and I look forward to meeting you next Saturday. Once again, we've been talking with Tim Giles here on Green Zine, and he will be presenting a workshop. And I'm betting the workshops are probably 45 to 50 minutes. I see that you're outdoors, and you're followed by off-grid solar with a good friend of ours, John Blittersdorf, and a couple of other folks, and that's also outdoors. So I think probably the turnaround time is 5 or 10 minutes from one workshop to the other. So you'll probably be 45 or 50 minutes. Really looking forward to the entire day. And thanks for giving us a call here on Green Zine, Tim.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you for what you do.
All right. Very welcome.
Look forward to visiting. So once again, this program is a free program. So Solarfest usually had a ticket price, and they've decided to let's just have it be free and see if we can get more people coming. And it's in Brandon, Vermont.
It is. It's easy to find if you were to go to Brandon, whatever direction. It's just north of the village of Brandon, which is a pretty good sized village on Route 7. You would go maybe about a half mile north, like you're going towards Middlebury, and you look for Steinberg Road on the left, and that'll bring you to the site. They've made some changes. There's camping available, etc. I'll be there camping. We're going to be doing a live remote from there next Saturday. So we'll be back on the radio again with our partners there at Solarfest. It's going to be great. Henry, why don't we take a moment to talk about just, or at least mention the other workshops that are going to be happening. We have about 4 minutes left in the program. The workshops do get started on Saturday morning, the 8th at 10 a.m. They've got two venues. One is indoors and one is outdoors. So Small Wind Myth Busting being put together by Roy Butler at 10 o'clock. And then at then Tim Giles will be outside at 10:30 with his DIY solar. And then in the agricultural world and gardening world at 11 a.m., Denise Siatsko from Native Earth Seed will be there. What is the seed saying? John Blittersdorf, Ryan Stankovitz, and Noel Langer presenting off-grid solar. And John Blittersdorf has been doing off-grid solar for as long as there's been off-grid solar, just about. And he is on the board of Solarfest as well. Hey, Micro Hydro back into the mix here. Theo Agnesturas will be presenting at noon. Water wheel hydro mechanism and generator build and operation. For you mycelium fans, Mushroom Workshop with Matt Bristol outdoors. More PV, DIY PV, lessons learned the hard way. Window dressers, and we've had people on talking about window dressers before at 1:30. Alternative wall systems. So some construction advice from Jeff Dardosi. A site walk will happen. John Blittersdorf leading that at 2:30. Methane gas and hydrogen generator build and climate change effects. What's new with portable balcony solar? We've talked about that. Hey, Mike Bailey involved with that, along with Steve Kirkoski, who I know from a meeting last night. Powering cars and homes, saving money with solar and wind, Dr. Myle Tyree. And then it'll all wrap up as far as the discussion part, although discussions will probably go late into the evening. Former lieutenant governor and now back to farming, not running for anything this year. The keynote speaker at 5 will be David Zuckerman. There'll also be live music all afternoon. Pretty busy time, and as I said, camping available. There will be food vendors there, and the site is looking pretty nice, Henry. I was just over there yesterday.
Excellent, yeah.
So that's coming up. Any little tidbits, Henry, in the last couple minutes you want to drop on people here while we're still on the air?
No, I think we have packed the show pretty well. I continue to be waiting for someone to talk about what the effective use of AI is.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And don't know. The news is doing it. I keep hearing more and more.
Every day.
Every day.
Every day. Every day AI, just for you, just for me, et cetera. Now, that almost sounds like a commercial. We are a commercial-free Free Vermont Radio at WFVRLP South Royalton. Hey, a couple more things that are local that you might want to check out. Ongoing discussions from Two Rivers Ottauquechee Regional Planning Commission. They have a draft out, and there's some people that have some questions they want to ask about some language in there that may be getting away from some of the intentions of regional towns. If you are available tonight, I think this is happening on Thursday, down in White River Junction, there'll be a draft regional plan discussion discussion happening at the Bugbee Senior Center and also at the headquarters of Two Rivers tomorrow, King Farm in Woodstock at 6 p.m. There'll be plenty of chances to weigh in on this. And now to our underwriters here on Green Zine. Thank you to Bale, Tom Wells, Daniel Leibowitz, the Upper Pass Beer Company, and the Yes We Can Collective. Henry, great to have you back in the studio.
It's fun to be here. I'm sorry that I'm remote as much as I am, but that works too.
All right. Well, you might be soloing again in a couple of weeks. Stay tuned for Democracy Now!